Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello there, Buzzkillers. It's your favorite professor here, talking to you from the Buzzkill Bunker. But we're about to leave the bunker. We're going to go to Washington, D.C. to talk to Laura Trevelyan from the BBC, who just published a new book with Yale University Press called The Winchester, The Gun That Built an American Dynasty. And I wanted to let you know, before I left, that we're having a contest about this book. The first Buzzkiller who emails me at info@professorbuzzkill.com and says they'd love to have a copy of this book is going to win a signed copy of the book. So please email right away before the show's over, info@professorbuzzkill.com. And now, off to D.C. So here we are, Buzzkillers, in Georgetown in the District of Columbia with Laura Trevelyan from the BBC, from BBC America, technically speaking?
Technically speaking, BBC World News. We're not on BBC America currently, actually, BBC News. We're on PBS and we're on cable as BBC World News.
Okay.
You're quite right, be on BBC America.
Right. But more importantly, of course, you're, at least for now, you're the author of this fantastic new history of the Winchester, the rifle that built America.
Well, that was very nice of you to say, Joe.
And thanks for coming on the show. And we should tell the Buzzkillers out there that we're in a beautiful courtyard, but of course, it's in the middle of D.C., and we just saw a vice presidential motorcade go by and caused a lot of disturbance, so there might be some noise. But we love the sort of live, as it is, as it's happening aspect
absolutely.
Of this place. So.
A little bit of history, the Obama administration and its closing months behind
right.
us there with
Joe
Biden going past.
So tell us how you got interested in writing this particular history, because you've written other books, but this one is a particularly special one for you.
Because the last 12 years, my husband and I and our family, we've lived in America.
Right.
And through that, I found out that my great-great-great-grandfather, Oliver Winchester, founded the Winchester Repeating Arms Company in New Haven. And I knew this dimly from visiting America as a teenager with my father and going to a summer holiday home that the family has in Bramford, Connecticut, close to New Haven. And that was bought with Winchester money, with gun money, around the turn of the 20th century.
Right.
So I knew that there was an association. But then when I moved here, of course, I wanted to know more about it. And then turns out to be this incredible story, really, of the family mirroring the story of America at a crucial time in the 19th century, the Civil War, the westward expansion, all the way to the First World War, when the company spectacularly goes bust just before the Depression. And, you know, it's a real rags to riches to rags again story.
Yes, it's absolutely fascinating. It is very, very complicated. The people would be fascinated to hear that he starts at your great-great-great-grandfather,
yep,
Oliver
greats.
Starts off as a shirt maker.
Well, he starts off as a penniless farm boy outside of Boston. I mean, his father dies. His mother is left with all of these children. His father had been married twice, so there are many, many children. He only gets to go to school when he can't work on the farm.
Yeah.
And somehow he apprentices himself to become a flying buttress maker for the churches, which I guess were so popular in New England at the time.
Mm.
And then from that, he becomes a shirt manufacturer. And he designs actually that very fine and patents, that fine shirt collar that you gentlemen all enjoy today.
Yeah.
So he makes a lot of money out of that.
Right.
In his shirt factory in New Haven, he has all these seamstresses and he's, you know, very interested in new technology. So Oliver invests in sewing machines so he can be even more productive. And he's made all this money. He's looking for something to invest it in. And it's war is on the horizon. The Civil War is on the horizon.
This is late 1850s we're talking
about? Yeah, exactly. Okay. He's looking for somewhere to put his money. And there's a rifle that's being made in New Haven, a newfangled repeating rifle. So he puts his money into that, although he knows nothing about rifles.
Yeah, I thought that was an absolutely fascinating part of the book because in some ways he is dealing with patterns, and I don't mean dressmaking patterns, but sewing machines are having interchangeable parts and that sort of thing, and sort of mechanization of arms of making guns is a new thing as well.
Yeah, and because he's familiar with patents, because that's how he patented his shirt collar, and he knows the importance of patents in protecting your work. So straight away he sees with guns that if there's a good design, you need to protect it with a patent,
right?
Which is what happens. But as Ed Pugsley, who was a married into the family in later life said Oliver knew nothing about guns and the company kept on going bust before breakfast. But Oliver would somehow find new investors, and New Haven at that time was full of wealthy individuals. There were carriage makers, clock makers, and all these people were putting their money into guns. So eventually, after a few failed starts, Oliver names the company after himself, the Winchester Repeating Arms Company.
Right.
And they have a rifle, the Henry rifle,
right,
which one Benjamin Henry, it's named after him, and he has the patent, which looks like it's going to work.
Right, right. And what let's explain to the buzzkillers so they know, what is a repeating rifle, or why is a repeating rifle such an innovation? What is it and why?
So back in the 19th century, if you were firing a shot, you had to keep reloading your rifle. That was what happened. So it was quite a lengthy and laborious process.
You had to reload it like a musket.
Exactly. But a repeating rifle, you could keep firing.
Yeah.
You know, you could put your finger on the trigger and you could fire more than one.
Right.
In fact, one of the fascinating things about that is that army ordnance bods didn't like repeating rifles at all because they thought that they were going to be a waste of money, which brings us neatly to the Civil War and the difficulties that Oliver had actually in selling the Henry to anybody.
Right, which seems bizarre to me as I was reading the book, because of course you have this fantastic lever action thing that Cotton only puts the new bullet in the chamber, but Coxon gets it all ready to go, and he goes to the Union Army and says, well, you know, I've got this thing that's going to change everything, and they think it's going to end up just as a waste of bullets.
Yep, they think soldiers are going to be profligate, fire too many of these things, and it's going to be really expensive. And they also didn't trust the technology. But Lincoln himself, who was a gun buff,
yeah,
Abraham Lincoln, the president, he tried out the Henry and various other repeating rifles, and he could see that this was a weapon that could be very useful to the Union side. But he was, you know, overruled by the bureaucrats and the go-slowers and all of that. But what did happen in the Civil War is that individual regiments and individuals bought Henry rifles, and it was known as the damn Yankee rifle that kept on firing all week. So there were some sales, but they were pretty limited. But it was, I mean, the Illinois regiment was one that kitted itself out with Henrys because they found it to be such an effective weapon. But the army bureaucracy was not convinced.
No, well, we don't know whether Lincoln might have sort of said a quiet word to his old chums back in Illinois, you know, use this rifle. But it's almost mind-boggling to read that and to see that they couldn't think of, you know, they thought that loading with old mini balls and things like that were a better way of fighting the Battle of Gettysburg, when obviously they weren't. So how does Winchester then sort of survive the war? You would think it would make them. What do they have to do after the Civil War?
No, it doesn't make them at all. They sell a few thousand rifles. So the thing is still losing money. Oliver is still pouring cash into it, trying to find new investors and all the rest of it. But it's the next period of American history which really makes Winchester money. And that, of course, is the settling of the West and the moving frontier, which moves ever westward. So if you think the Civil War comes to an end and America turns back to its project of moving ever westward.
Right.
So you have former people in the army who go out west. They like the Winchester repeating rifle very much. They find it very useful. The Colt pistol and the Winchester repeating rifle becomes a classic combination.
Right.
And eventually Winchester comes up with the slogan, the gun that won the West.
That's right. A very good slogan.
Right. Much later on. But so everybody uses it, from cowboys to people who are guarding the mail. It's used against Native Americans in that slaughter, but Native Americans too become very keen on the gun they call the spirit gun because it keeps firing. And in fact, in a fascinating bit of history, at Custer's last stand, Native Americans use Winchesters and other repeating rifles successfully against Custer.
Oh, right. So it's turning it all back on this sort of...
Right.
On the American Army. Well, but you mentioned Colt a minute ago. One of the things we try to stress on the show is that to avoid the sort of analysis of determinism, you know, that, oh, once you invent this thing, then it's something, it just sort of takes a life of its own and everybody becomes rich and it takes over the West. But there was a lot of competition. There was Colt and other people, and they all seem to be springing from Connecticut for some reason.
Yeah, there was a ton of competition, but Oliver was a very adept salesman.
Right.
During the Civil War, Oliver personally wrote letters to all the border states saying, you know, under a pseudonym, saying, have you guys heard of this tremendous repeating rifle, the Henry, which could tip the balance? I do think that if only the Union men could be armed with it, it could change the course of the war. And Oliver carried on with this PR. But it also, I think it was just very practical when you were on your horse and you were galloping and you were trying to kill buffalo or you were trying to settle the land. And of course, I mean, the horrific part of the story is the Native Americans who were slaughtered by this weapon. In fact, someone took me to task in a review in for not apologizing for this personally. Although I guess
as
I don't.
As if you were, I guess I don't, as a descendant,
I don't, I don't personally feel that the guilt is on me, but it's a horrific slaughter. And I read the Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee because I was trying to get, there's very little information, as you know, from the Native American side about what happened. And that, I mean, that's such a poignant book.
Mm.
And that whole story of Andrew Jackson and the permanent frontier, you know, President Jackson, who said there was going to be a permanent frontier, but then he kept on moving it. And that meant that the slaughter of the Native Americans continued.
Yes. Now, not solely the Winchester repeating rifle isn't solely responsible. After all, there's the Colt pistol, which, you know, revolves and fires and can fire many shots in rapid succession. But it is a very, very transformative weapon, the Winchester's transformative weapon in the West. What happens when Native Americans are able to get their hands on them?
Well, it becomes a trophy. So Geronimo, who was a famed Native American leader, there's a fantastic photograph of him and three of his men with their Winchesters. They became prized. I mean, everybody loved to be photographed with their Winchester, whether it was a cowboy, whether it was a Native American. And very quickly, the folklore jumps up. And so you have Buffalo Bill, his traveling Wild West show. Well, that's we're jumping ahead a bit to the 1880s, but this, and Sitting Bull, who's a Native American chief, who also had a Winchester and found it to be very valuable. So Buffalo Bill and Sitting Bull go on tour together, and this Wild West show goes everywhere. It even goes to Paris.
Yeah.
And becomes
in front of Queen Victoria as well. Yeah.
Right, exactly. I'm not sure that Sitting Bull ever went to Paris, but certainly Buffalo Bill did.
Yeah.
So the legend of the West is alive and well. By 1880, this and the Winchester's role, its mythic role as a rifle beloved by cowboys, settlers, male men, male women, Native Americans alike, is cemented.
But what's so fascinating is that it's almost as if the production, we have one of the planes from Dulles flying over, undoubtedly a diplomat coming in. What's so fascinating is that despite all the increased sales because of the settlement of the West, Winchester finds it necessary to try to open up foreign markets.
Well, Oliver is never one to sit still. He's always thinking about, although he does very well in the Western years, and just to bring out all these different models, the Winchester 73, Winchester 86, and they're all selling very well, but he's thinking always about new models. And so by this point, his daughter, Jenny, has made an extremely good marriage to one Thomas Gray Bennett, who becomes Oliver's son-in-law. And Thomas Gray Bennett himself was a veteran of the Civil War.
Yeah.
He had seen the Henry used in Florida when he was a teenager on the Union side. So he knew firsthand the effectiveness of a repeating rifle. He went to work at Winchester after finishing at Yale University after the war. He went to work in the gun shop. He was an engineer. And then he married the boss's daughter.
Yeah.
Made a very good move, very good marriage to Jenny. And he was a big guy, Thomas Gray Bennett, a wrestler.
Yeah.
Incredibly shrewd and an absolutely fabulous writer. So Oliver immediately sends Thomas Gray Bennett off around the world to flog the Winchester.
Oh,
so he goes to Turkey.
Yeah.
Where the Turks, it's sort of getting towards the end of the Ottoman Empire, and the Turks are engaged in a war against the Russians. And they really like the look of this repeating rifle. And so Oliver becomes personally friends with the Sultan. And in fact, he's given a rather nice piece of jewelry at one point, which was in the family for a while and now seems to have disappeared, sadly.
Yeah.
And so Oliver is all about new markets.
Yeah.
He goes, sends sales representatives to Mexico, where the French are trying to prop up their ruler. And, you know, they end up selling weapons there too. So it's quite an extraordinary tale, especially when you think that back then you couldn't hop on a plane.
No,
these were journeys that took a very long time.
Yeah.
And Thomas Gray Bennett is stuck in Paris for months on end, waiting for the French to commit. And he writes all these lovely letters back to his wife, Jenny, in New Haven, in which he says, one of them I particularly like, where he's going to buy her a dress. She wants a fancy dress because he's in Paris. So, and he writes sadly, how I wish I could see you in or out of this dress. And he's stuck there, you know, weeks on end, waiting for people to make commitments about contracts. And even then, Winchester isn't, despite the West, Winchester is not flush with cash at all.
The company, yeah.
No. And so Thomas Gray Bennett is always, you know, waiting for money to be wired and all of this, and, you know, very anxious letters, but wonderful to read.
Do you think that's because of the competition with the other gun manufacturers, or is it because that the, you know, there just aren't enough cowboys to keep things going in the West? Or
I think it's also just that the cash flow day to day, you know, the amount of money that it took to staff the gun shops, to pay everybody. And there's a huge, you know, think how long it took to wire money from Istanbul to New Haven.
Yeah.
It probably took weeks. So although the overall cash flow position is good, I think short term, you know, they're still sort of going week to week. And then they get the big payoff and everything's good.
Yeah, but and of course, as made very clear in the book, they're having to constantly innovate. There's not only the Henry, but then the Winchester 73, then the 1880, you know, it's almost as if 10 years they have to reinvent the whole thing.
Well, and they had a stroke of luck, which is Thomas Gray Bennett, you know, scouts for Winchester were constantly sending them in what the competition were doing. And so the Browning brothers, famous names in gun making, Mormons in Utah.
Right.
So around 1880, a Winchester scout finds... Well, the story is unclear. There are two versions of it. One is that a Winchester scout finds a Browning rifle and sends it to Thomas Gray Bennett. The other is that Browning and Winchester became locked in a patent war over a very similar gun.
Right.
And it's not clear which is the truth of it. But either way, Thomas Gray Bennett hops on a train to Utah in 1880, which again took 3 or 4 days from New Haven in those days. And he's very scathing in his letters about the West. Mm-hmm. He says, finds it to be very overrated. The mountains are not really up to all of that. But he goes to the Browning Brothers workshop and he meets them. He thinks that their rifle is superb. And on the spot, he does a deal with them to pay them $10,000 for this rifle and for the next one. And also he says, will you give us first refusal on everything you make?
Right.
The Browning Brothers say, all right, sounds like a good deal. It's more money than they'd ever heard of.
And it's pretty clear that Browning is this sort of inventive genius in terms of rifles, because he's, you know, everything is
superb.
Everything,
but he doesn't do it from, he doesn't have shop drawings. He's completely unconventional. He does it all from his head and by feel. So just quite extraordinary. But so he makes a deal with Thomas Gray Bennett. And that's a good relationship for 20-odd years, but it goes sour in the 20th century when Browning has a new invention and he wants a royalty share. And Thomas Gray Bennett does not do royalties. He just does one-off payments, and then he gets to make all the money from the gun. And so Browning, who by then knows his own worth...
Yeah.
You know, they have a...
It's probably been courted by Colt and the other
people. Well, by everybody, and also by the Remington. European manufacturers at that point.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, you say there's this big contract he's dealing with in Belgium.
Right, exactly. So he just takes himself off and swears at Thomas Gray Bennett, who swears back, and that's the end of their business relationship.
There's nothing better than 19th century swearing, by the way.
Right, exactly. Yeah. All because Thomas Gray Bennett is too tight to pay royalties to this genius gun maker.
Yeah.
But it was, for a long time, an extremely profitable relationship. And Browning's visits to the New Haven factory were highly anticipated. It must have been like Christmas when he came.
Right.
But Winchester also helped him because they were able to refine what he had done and they would deal with all the patents for him and do all of the technical work. But Browning, it's interesting if you read his side of the story. You know, his one of his aunts is very suspicious of these Yankees who she's convinced are taking him for a ride. And probably true.
Yeah. One of the fascinating things about one of the many fascinating things, and I keep saying fascinating buzzkillers, but I do mean that, is that the Winchester is seen not only as a fantastic rifle for military use, it's seen as a fantastic rifle for conquering the West and, of course, buffalo hunting. But one of the things that really stood out to me was when Ida Wells, the great anti-lynching campaigner, talks about it as a defense weapon for African Americans.
Right. I mean, that's really an extraordinary bit of the book, because after the Civil War, maybe you can find the quote, Joe, because it's so brilliant. But after the Civil War, when there's a backlash, particularly in the southern states, against any of the rights, because after the abolition of slavery, and there's just this horrible period during Reconstruction when lynchings are common.
Right. And Jim Crow is on the rise.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And all of that. And so Ida Wells, who's this diminutive school teacher turned civil rights activist, and she sees that African Americans from Florida to Kentucky are using the Winchester rifles to defend themselves from lynching. And she says, the lesson this teaches, and which every Afro-American should ponder well, is that the Winchester rifle deserves a place of honor in every black home. The more the Afro-American yields and cringes and begs, the more he's insulted, outraged, and lynched. And then one of her kindred spirits, T. Thomas Fortune, who established the Age newspaper in New York, also an activist for black civil rights and endorsing armed self-defense, he says, we've cringed and crawled long enough. I don't want any more good niggers. I want bad niggers. It's the bad nigger with the Winchester who can defend his home and children and wife.
Right.
Which is fascinating. So everybody who was under siege, whether you were a Native American or an African American, you saw the value of this repeating rifle to defend yourself, your home, your family.
Yeah, because if a mob comes at you, a single shotgun isn't going to do much good, but a repeating rifle can do exactly that.
Right. But it's the thought of this tiny school teacher, Ida Wells.
Yeah. Well, she's a hero.
But the fact that she articulates the need for black self-defense and the importance of the Winchester, I just found that, well, to use your word, I found it to be fascinating, but also compelling.
Yeah. And also to think of the horror of it all, that, you know, when the mob is closing in on you, that you have to rely on this new technology.
Yeah, I mean, it's terrifying. And, you know, for those who don't perhaps think about history that clearly, people think of the Civil War and the abolition of slavery and everything being just fine after that. But, of course, it wasn't just fine at all. There was this huge backlash, lynchings, Reconstruction era, Jim Crow. And we see it even today. We see that voting restrictions in the southern states, in those states who the Supreme Court said they didn't need to anymore be on probation, and so they could have that civil rights era law lifted, which didn't mean they had to first of all get federal clearance to change anything to do with voting. And that's lifted, and straight away there are various instances of voting restrictions being introduced, but all under the name of trying to eliminate voter fraud, of course.
Yeah, that's right. And, well, let's hope we don't have rifles showing up at the voting booths, but, you know, who knows what's going to happen after this election. Another huge figure, and I mean huge in almost every way, in this story is Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt is iconic with the Winchester.
He certainly is. There's a fantastic photograph of Teddy in his fringed cowboy gear with his, I don't know what kind of creature it is that died to make his hat, maybe a beaver or something. But there's Teddy posing with his Winchester. And that was key to Teddy's reinvention of himself, in fact.
Right.
His period. And he has, which goes all the way through to when he's president. So, first of all, before he's active in politics, he goes out west after a family tragedy, and he finds himself out west, and the Winchester is key to that. So he's really hunting is what he's doing there. Mm. But then when he's president, the obsession with hunting continues, and he wants to go big game hunting in Africa. And he gets Winchester to custom make him rifles for himself and his son, Kermit. And even though he's president and no doubt is very busy, he engages in this meticulous correspondence with poor old Winchester Bennett, who's my great-grandfather, who I guess was in charge of VIP correspondence.
Corresponding only with presidents.
Pretty much. And it was a full-time job because, Teddy, a year before his trip to Africa, he starts to want the rifles and he wants to know what kind of ammunition is going to work for shooting elephants. And
right.
All, serious business. And the White House tell Winchester that they're under no circumstances are they to publicize the fact that the president is using them to arm himself for this trip to Africa.
Because it's an advertisement.
Because it's advertising, which of course is agonizing for the company. But then as Teddy goes, they nonetheless take out a full page ad saying that he's going to Africa and that exciting things are happening. And of course, Teddy doesn't mind at all because he's a massive self-publicist. So,
well, exactly. And there are enough pictures of him with the rifles that it's almost advertising itself.
Oh, right. There's a wonderful picture that I love of the ammunition. It's just the ammunition for his trip. Just boxes and
and
boxes of it. And he's obsessed with when is it going to arrive in Kenya and all the rest of it. So, but at the end of his trip, the results end up at the Natural History Museum, which is, well, some go to the Smithsonian and then the Natural History Museum in New York, which, of course, he was a founder of. So
there's a whole Roosevelt room,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In fact, I think there are several Roosevelt rooms. I remember seeing them ever since I was a kid. You know, you walk in and all of a sudden there are all kinds of animals. As the 19th century sort of draws to a close, though, we get what becomes a sort of very tragic story in the family, in the person of Sarah Winchester. And this is one of the big myths that comes up about Winchester family history and the gun and the legacy of the gun and all that sort of thing. What happens there?
Yeah, so Sarah Winchester, I don't know if anyone listening has been out to San Mateo in California.
The Bay Area is our number one market.
Ah, okay. So then I think listeners will be familiar with the Winchester Mystery House, which is the house that Sarah Winchester built. But let's just rewind and tell you who she is. So she married Oliver Winchester's son, William Wirt Winchester, who Oliver groomed to take over the company.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly after Oliver died in 1880, William Wirt got tuberculosis.
Right.
Or some kind of lung disease. I think it's TB. And he died, tragically, leaving Sarah widowed. And they had already lost a baby daughter a few years earlier. So this was a second blow to Sarah.
Very tragic life already,
I mean, but this was the 19th century. This is people endured this kind of horror. So she was extremely sad, as you would expect, and extremely rich because Oliver had died. The money had gone to his son, William Wirt, who then died. So it went to Sarah. And when her mother-in-law, Jenny, died, she inherited even more, Oliver's widow. So she became wealthy beyond measure. I mean, the newspapers regularly said she was worth 20 to 30 million. So she left New Haven.
Right.
I guess it represented sadness to her. She suffered ill health herself, and she went out west. And as you do when you're a wealthy widow, she decided to indulge her interests, which were architecture, design. So she started building this house. And the myth about her is that she was haunted by the ghosts of those killed by the Winchester, haunted by the spirits of Native Americans and everyone else who'd been killed in the settling of the West, and that she met with a medium in Boston who told her, as long as you keep building your house, the spirits will never come and get you. But if you stop building, they'll come for you.
And what was the idea, that you're building more rooms for the departed souls, or there's something?
It's a little unclear, but yes, I think so, that this will somehow appease the spirits.
Okay.
Although why? I mean, it doesn't really make much sense, because it would give them somewhere to roam at night, ever-increasing number.
Yeah.
So this is a myth, but there's no evidence anywhere that she visited a medium in Boston. I mean, literally nothing. And in her letters, there are only a few which survived, but there are a few letters back to family in New Haven. And she never once mentions feeling guilty.
Right.
And she obviously doesn't do anything to renounce the fortune.
she doesn't give it away.
But she does build this extraordinary house, which it's extraordinary because it has these corridors upon turrets, because she just keeps going. She never stops. She finally stops after the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. And the house is rather mangled by that, so which partly explains its odd appearance, because she just made it safe after that, really. So, but she's quite a brilliant character. I mean, she's highly intelligent. She's fluent in many languages. And she is an architect.
Yeah.
I mean, not a trained one, which is why the house is so weird. But she has all these fine materials shipped in from all over the world, and she's obsessed with it. But when you read her letters, they are extremely sad because she's also obsessed with death. She writes all the time about how she wants to be buried next to her husband in New Haven. She's right. obsessed with funeral arrangements. When her mother-in-law dies, she wants to know exactly how she was laid out in her coffin.
And did she look lifelike in that?
Yeah, every single that detail. Yeah, yeah. And she's obsessed also with the way that she's going to leave her money to her nieces and nephews. And she's obsessed with the idea that there's one black sheep in the family who inherits a lot of money and then loses it all and has a terrible divorce, which is all over the society pages. So
right.
because she's, I guess, still the frugal New Englander, despite all her spending, she doesn't want the money to go to waste. So she sets up these trusts for her nieces and nephews. She must have spent just years on estate planning.
Mm.
These complicated trusts so that when she dies, this still huge amount of money will go not to her nieces and nephews. They'll have trust funds and they'll get an income for their lifetime. But when they die, the principal all goes to the pneumonia clinic in Yale, which
right.
she is setting up in memoriam for her dead husband, William Wirt, who died of tuberculosis. So she wants tuberculosis research, lung research to be the focus. And so she endows, and to this day, the chest clinic, as it's now called, in New Haven, because tuberculosis is no longer a killer in the way it was in the 19th century.
Right.
Sarah's legacy lives on to this day. And I was in correspondence with the director of the chest clinic, who said she regularly thanks Sarah for her foresight and
right,
for the fact that she's left what must be millions of dollars to fund continuing research into diseases of the chest. And this is all because Sarah was obsessed with the fact that William had died young of pneumonia, and how could it possibly have been prevented, and what could she do? So she's this meticulous woman who, she seems obsessed with death, she's grieving, but she's not crazy, and there's certainly no evidence that she roamed, the halls of her house at night and communed with the spirits, which is the myth.
Yeah, and we don't like to make too many assumptions like this, but I think you can safely assume that if she was told by the medium to do this and she was consumed with guilt, that she would have left money for the Carlisle Indian School or built other Native American or had
right.
other Native American charities, if you will.
Yeah.
But she's, of course, still thinking about her husband rather than...
Yeah.
Yeah,
and she's thinking about how to stop other people dying of tuberculosis. That's
right.
her focus. But she's also, you know, family is... she's very close to her family, although she never wants to see anybody, any of the Winchester clan who tried to visit her
right.
in this house. So she's very reclusive, which, of course, fuels all the stories naturally.
Yeah. She's reclusive because of the guilt for the thing,
right.
and on and on and on.
But
yeah.
she also withdrew. I mean, there were lots of articles in the newspapers at the time about how she was crazy and how she was haunted by the spirits, and how she was, there was even a joke in one of the newspapers about the Carpenters Union being the spirit union because they must have made so much money from Sarah and
yeah.
her guilt. So
yeah.
she retreats from that. She can't deal with it. And she's arthritic. Her movement is limited. She's shy.
Right.
But when Winchester Bennett, who's my great-grandfather, and his wife, Susan, try and visit her soon after they get married, she won't even receive them, despite
right.
the fact that she corresponds all the time with family back in New Haven. So she's definitely... eccentric,
right.
For
but that
sure.
does, yeah, sure. But do we know if the tour guides at the Winchester Mystery House still tell this story about the guilt and the?
Yeah, I mean, of course, and it's a wonderful story.
And they
carefully phrase it with "it's believed that,"
oh, right,
"it's
yeah.
thought that," and as the official guidebook to the Mystery House points out, you know, we don't have evidence to the contrary. As
true,
it were.
True.
Sarah hasn't written, "I'm not obsessed with guilt and guns." it's a myth. But to me, it's just interesting because widows are so often stigmatized. I mean, to this day,
right.
you know, widows around the world, people try and seize their property and their land in countries where the rule of law isn't properly enforced. I've done stories about the plight of Indian widows, for
mm-hmm.
example. And there is something about a wealthy widow
right.
that people will zero in on and just want to know more about, I guess.
And one of the tragedies is, this seems to happen a lot with these myths that we explode on the show, is that by concentrating on the things that she didn't do, people are, in a way, ignoring the great Long Hospital in New Haven. I mean, everyone in New Haven knows about it, or everyone at Yale knows about it, but that's right. A very big deal. And she doesn't, if you will, get enough credit for that. She gets credit for
it's not
this
mentioned,
guilt about... Right.
Right. It's, for example, in the guidebook for the Winchester Mystery House,
yeah,
the fact that she left all this money and so carefully set up her will so that her millions, which produced an income for her nieces and nephews during their lifetime, the fact that she set it up so that this money could go to the tuberculosis clinic, it's not mentioned. And yet that was a huge part of her life's work, was she had this wonderful lawyer who just adored her,
right,
and said very clearly to anyone who would listen that she wasn't crazy. She was one of the sanest people he'd ever met. And that was what her staff felt too. But, you know, of course, their voices were soon drowned out.
Right.
But at the same time, I completely understand the compelling nature of the story of the ghosts and
absolutely,
the guns and the guilt. And she was clearly highly eccentric.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And of course, that's why, you know, Professor Buzzkill makes so much money. These myths keep us in business.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah, oh yeah, we're rolling in it. And the Institute is heavily funded until the next century. The sort of, if you will, last big figure or image figure in Winchester history is Hemingway.
Oh, yes.
Talk about that.
Well, who could be more appropriate, as it were? He's another larger-than-life character, isn't he?
Right. He's the literary Teddy Roosevelt. He's, you know, very exactly, big and burly and very manly.
So Hemingway, when he's in Cuba, has a Winchester. In fact, his six-year-old son learns to fire one when they're down in the Caribbean.
Yikes.
He gives one to Martha Gellhorn, who doesn't particularly like it, and after they split up, he gets it back. But yeah, I mean, he indulges in all kinds of antics with his Winchester. He likes to shock people, so he fires it at parties and
that's right.
The rest of it. It's part of his swashbuckling, romanticized image. I guess, the literary Wild West, as it were,
right.
and there's Hemingway right in it, making myths all of his own with his Winchester.
Right, and stories about his shooting the ash off cigarettes that people have in their hands or in their mouth. It just sounds like...
Yeah.
You know, it sounds crazy. There's big game fishing, the big marlin fishing that he does, and there's this sort of rifle marksmanship he keeps trying.
Right, and he likes to, as you say, likes to do that at parties, try and fire at cigarette ash. I mean, it's just completely insane.
Yeah.
But, so he also becomes rather a good advertisement for Winchester right, later in the 20th century, much as Teddy was in the late 19th century.
So what happens to the company... After the sort of after the wars anyway in the 20th century, what happens as the 20th century starts to come to a close?
Well, it's what's so interesting is that so Winchester does just fine until the start of the war, World
right,
War One. So
right,
because it's built these patent fences around all the very successful Browning guns,
sure,
and because they're still being sold, you know, for shooting, mm-hmm, so people are enjoying target practice with them, basically. And they've done well with these foreign sales in the late 19th century. But oddly enough, you'd think that World War One would have been a fantastic opportunity for an arms manufacturer and that they would have just made tons of money. But Thomas Gray Bennett, Oliver Winchester's son-in-law, who was not a man that liked to do business with the government, he warned against it because he thought the government was a bad customer.
They wouldn't pay or take forever
to
pay.
That would just was inefficient, that wasn't part of the capitalist system. So he didn't want to bid for any government contracts ever. He thought that this was a terrible idea. But when the war came along, people approached Winchester. The first, in fact, to approach Winchester were the British, who, of course, were in the war before the Americans.
Right, right.
And very reluctantly, Winchester agreed that they would modify these rifles for the British, the Enfield rifle. Although the Winchester engineers were not happy about it, they felt that it was going to be a botched job. And the British send over this dashing army chap with the designs, and this is exactly how it has to be. And the Winchester mm-hmm. engineers say, well, this isn't going to work. It's not going to fire very well. We don't think this is happening. And they're told, make it. So they do. Sure enough, doesn't fire.
Right.
They've got these contracts with the British. Some of them are cancelled because it's going to take too long to make this remodified rifle. It's all just a complete mess. So, but meanwhile, they expand all their facilities because they can see the Americans are going to go into the war. And yeah, there will be more business coming. Plus, they've got this British business. Plus, the Russians are asking them to make things. Plus, ammunition. Demand for ammunition is going just crazy. So they're making a ton of ammunition. Yeah. But essentially what happens is then when the Americans come into the war, they have fixed price contracts to make rifles and ammunition for the government. But the contracts are fixed price.
Yeah.
The cost of raw materials goes through the roof. The cost of labor goes through the roof.
Oh, sure. Wartime, yeah.
Because there's so much demand. And they've spent so much on expanding the premises and partly betting that the war is going to last longer than it does. Remember, the Americans come into the war late.
1917, yeah.
So none of the sums add up. And Winchester Bennett, who is the son of Thomas Gray Bennett and the grandson of Oliver Winchester, my great-grandfather. So he's at the helm the beginning of World War One, and he's a very different individual to his father and to Oliver. He's suffered from, seems to be, nervous anxiety is the euphemism throughout his life.
Yeah.
He's always been quite anxious, quite highly strung. He's always been very ill, various ailments, his back, his kidneys. In fact, eventually...
Oh, well, hang on. I think the president's flying over in a helicopter right now as we speak. This is very exciting for the Buzz Killers because we don't normally have live...
Fine-looking, you know, U.S. government helicopters.
Yeah,
there,
absolutely.
Flying overhead. But, yeah, so Winchester Bennett, he's in charge during the beginning of World War One, and he's not really up to the task. And, in fact, gets very ill during the war and steps down. And so his father, who's in his 70s, Thomas Gray Bennett, comes back to the company.
Oh, okay.
But is rather reluctantly, but realizes that someone needs to be there. But it feels too old to run it, so looks around for new leadership. But anyway, they end the war owing millions of dollars to the bank.
Right.
And with all these facilities that they have. And what do? The sensible thing, as it turns out, would have been to shutter all of the facilities and not try and use them. But what they do is they have, at the time, there was this sort of chain of chemists across the company called Rexall, meaning Latin for king of all.
Right.
And the guy from Rexall comes in and is put on the board of Winchester, and he says, oh, what you need to do with all this spare space is just make stuff. You know, your manufacturers make stuff which is as good as the gun, is the slogan. So Winchester diversifies into washing machines, skates, ice skates, knives.
Winchester washing machines.
Yep, yep.
The repeating bats, Washington machine.
Baseball bats.
Actually, and I remember that there's still being Winchester bats around when I was a
kid. All of this. I mean, they make every kind of household good that's made out of steel. They make ice skates. They make roller skates. And they spend a huge amount of money on fancy stores in the middle of New York, Boston.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, the gun people have gone into the business of housewares.
Right.
Cutlery. But the whole thing is just a catastrophic failure. It costs a fortune to make all this stuff. They don't really have expertise.
Right.
They're not good at making knives and forks, it turns out. Other people are better. Their investment in the stores is more than they have. And then in the 20s, you have the Depression. Oh,
here
there's another
again.
Helicopter.
I wonder if that's a Winchester helicopter. The blades, the rotor blades.
Right.
Probably Winchester.
So, and then you have the Depression of 1929, so then there's no money anyway.
Yeah.
And the company goes bust, and it's put up for sale in 1931.
Wow. Yeah.
And Thomas Gray Bennett blames the bankers.
Oh, right.
And says, the bankers have put them more and more in debt and should never have done business with the government.
Yeah, and at least in his vision of how it worked, he turned out to be right. Well, we want to advertise the book in the best possible way.
It's going
to be it's on the Buzzkill bookshelf now for our readers, and we're going to have a special sort of contest. The first Buzz Killer who emails me after this show comes out and tells me, of course, that they love the show and they subscribe and they tell all their friends, is going to get a signed copy of The Winchester, the gun that built an American dynasty by Laura Trevelyan, out from Yale University Press, at least in the United States, in 2016, fresh off the presses. And thank you so much for being on the show. It's been very enlightening, and we hope that, you know...
Well, thank you, Joe, for the opportunity, and thank you to everyone who is listening out there. And I hope whoever gets the book enjoys it very much.
Oh, I think they will. I enjoyed it, and I'm sure they will. We're putting a good review on the website. So thanks again, Buzzkillers, and thanks to Laura, and we'll talk to you next week.
Epicast.